This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. UN investigators have condemned the actions of the military commander of Myanmar, also known as Burma, along with five generals for overseeing mass murder and rape of Muslim Rohingya last year with, quote, genocidal intent, and called for their prosecution. Christopher Sidati is one of those investigators.
We are not removing the presumption of innocence. We are not saying that they individually have been proven to have the necessary intent, but we are saying that given all of the circumstances, all of the inference, all of the facts that we have found, and we have found extensive range of facts, and the tightness of the chain of military command, they should be investigated and prosecuted.
They also took aim at de facto civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi for failing to use her moral authority to protect civilians. Nicholas Farrelly is a regional analyst at the Australian National University.
What we've seen over the past year is that there were great failings, including at the very highest level in the State Councillor's office, and this is going to have very significant consequences. Aung San Suu Kyi's personal reputation was, at least among serious analysts, already shredded by what had happened last year.
Investigators also took aim at the social media network Facebook for allowing the spread of hate speech and inciting violence in Myanmar. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta was welcomed to the White House Monday, by President Donald Trump.
Kenya and the United States have had strong, solid relationships ever since our independence. We are here to renew that partnership. We are here to strengthen it. We've had very good and excellent cooperation, especially in our fight against terrorism.
Both leaders focused on trade, investment, and security, and have military forces battling jihadists in Somalia. Mr. Kenyatta, the second African leader to visit the White House under Mr. Trump. This is VOA News. President Trump Monday said the U.S. and Mexico agreed to alter the 24-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement.
It wasn't from any standpoint something that most people thought was even doable when we started. If you look at it, you remember at the beginning, many people thought that this was something that just couldn't happen because of all of the different factions, all of the different sides, and the complexity. And we made it much simpler, much better for both countries.
The negotiations among the U.S., Mexico, and Canada have dragged on for more than a year. Canada will rejoin the negotiations later Tuesday. Japan says North Korea continues to pose a dire threat to its security, despite recent diplomatic rapprochement between the Koreas and Pyongyang and Washington. Yoichiro Sato is a security expert.
Despite the meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un and the agreement that came out of it in June, the Japanese government does not see any tangible progress in North Korea's denuclearization.
The Japanese Defense Ministry warned in its annual white paper the North's military activities pose the most serious and pressing threat their country has faced. It also raised concerns over China's military buildup and modernization and its assertiveness in both the South and East China Seas. Iranian lawyers have asked the International Court of Justice, known as the World Court, to order the U.S. to lift sanctions. Tehran insists they violate terms of a 1955 bilateral friendship treaty. Mohsen Mohabi is a law advisor to Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani.
Mr. President, the case at hand is in fact very simple, because the United States is publicly propagating a policy intended to damage as severely as possible Iran's economy and Iranians' nationals and companies, and therefore inevitably Iranian nationals, of course.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the suit is intended to interfere with the sovereign rights of the U.S. to take lawful actions to protect its national security. The defense ministers of Iran and Syria Monday signed an agreement on military cooperation and reconstruction. Following a seven-year civil war, the U.S. and Israel demand Iran leave Syria. Police in Ethiopia arrested the former head of the Eastern Somali region on rights abuse charges and fomenting ethnic unrest. The arrest of Abdi Mohamed Omar, who resigned his post, came days after Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said he would face charges following fighting earlier this month in the regional capital. And Uganda's top court has granted bail to more than 30 people, including pop songwriter turned politician Robert Kyagulanyi, charged with treason over their alleged role in stoning the presidential motorcade. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda MP Bobi Wine has been granted bail, but his lawyers say he needs medical treatment abroad.
He was badly beaten. He has several bruises all over the body, but in particular, he's got extensive pain in the hip, and we suspect there could also be a problem with the kidneys, and we think the treatment locally may not be satisfactory.
Menda Segona is MP Bobi Wine's lawyer. Malawi President Mutharika refused corruption charges, but the opposition says it stands by its allegations. South Sudan resumes oil production in its former unity state. And a row in Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, the IEBC.
IEBC does not have offices for former commissioners. And so, as far as we are concerned, they are not supposed to be working here. And this has to be made very, very clear to the country.
Wafula Chibukati is chair of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, and experts discuss how to save Madagascar's lemur population from extinction. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A lawyer for detained popular Ugandan parliamentarian Robert Chagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, said he is in need of foreign medical treatment. Menda Segona says Bobi Wine was badly beaten while in the custody of the military, leaving him with several bruises, extensive pain in the hip, and the possibility of an injury to his kidney. Segona says local treatment may not be satisfactory. Bobi Wine and 32 of his co-accused were granted bail yesterday, Monday, by a magistrate's court in Guru, Uganda. They were charged last Thursday with treason in the same court after the military court had dropped charges for possession of firearms. Lawyer Segona says he's happy his client was granted bail, but expressed regret that Uganda would torture its citizens in violation of its own constitution.
He's not well. He's in bad health because of the torture that he sustained during detention by the military forces. So he definitely cannot be a happy man. Mine, yes, I'm happy to have security relieved and to have attained this again.
What do you make of what happened the last 2 weeks?
Well, regrettable that we have a country where we have all laws against torture, and the country's agencies can go ahead to torture citizens for no offense committed. Nobody has a right to torture the other. So it's been an acrimonious period. It's regrettable. It's not something that we should be talking about in the history of humanity.
How would you describe the reaction of Ugandans and the overall international reaction? Would you say that it played a major part in what happened today?
Well, I'm pleased to know, first of all, that both Ugandans and the international community paid attention to the suffering of these particular individuals. I am delighted to know that the people of Uganda are conscious and that they can stand up for their rights. I am happy with the international community that did not desert Ugandans at the time of need. It has been a tremendous and commendable reaction from both our international colleagues and the people of Uganda. The reaction of the state has also been ugly, but the people of Uganda, yes, I must thank them for standing up to defend their constitution, to defend their rights. It's not about defending a particular individual, the Honorable Chagulanyi, otherwise known as Bobi Wine. To me, it's about defense of the constitution, defense of our civility, defense of our people, the defense of our values.
So this is not over. What's next? I understand, Mr. Bobi Wine, your client is supposed to be going back to court.
Well, he's supposed to go back to court Thursday this week, which is 30th, to report. But like I said, he's not in good health. We've booked him into hospital direct from prison, and we're trying to see if we can secure an opportunity to have treatment abroad for the torture sustained and suspected lethal injections or injections of an ugly nature, if I may describe.
You say he's not well. I'm reading that he was transported from Arua to Kampala in an ambulance.
Yes, he traveled by ambulance because he's not in good health, like I said. He was badly tortured. He cannot stand by himself. He can't support himself. So he needed definitely an ambulance to bring him from Gulu to the hospital where he has been checked in. And I hope better now that he will be managed medically. It's my sincere hope and prayer that he will be better.
You mentioned a possibility of him getting some medical attention abroad. Do you think that is something the government,
yes,
President Museveni's government, will make possible?
The possibility is not far-fetched. We are very suspicious of what he could have been injected with. We're very suspicious of the extent of his torture. He was badly beaten. He has several bruises all over the body, but in particular, he's got extensive pain in the hip, and we suspect there could also be a problem with the kidney. So we need to rule them out, and we think the treatment locally may not be satisfactory. That's why we have intention of ensuring that he receives treatment abroad.
Meda Sigona is the lawyer for Ugandan parliamentarian and popular musician Bobby Wine. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The chair of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, the IEBC, has rejected a move by three former commissioners to claim their places on the commission after they had resigned last April. Commission chairperson Wafula Chibukati says the process to replace the three is already underway. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the return of the three commissioners has caused an uproar.
Drama began last Friday when IEBC Vice Chairperson Consolata Maina and Commissioner Margaret Mwachanya returned to the Commission's headquarters. The two demanded to meet with the chairman of the electoral body, Wafula Chebukati, but their request was denied. Chairman Wafula Chebukati issued a statement yesterday, Monday, saying that Vice Chairperson Consolata Maina and Commissioner Margaret Mwachanya were no longer members of the commission.
IEBC does not have offices for former commissioners. You cannot come here and say, I'm a former commissioner, give me space to work from here. And so, as far as we are concerned, they are not supposed to be working here. And this has to be made very, very clear to the country that there's no place for former commissioners in the IEBC. And we were surprised to learn that they had retained some of the keys which they had not handed over and accessed their offices. But that has now been rectified.
Mr. Chebukati says the rules of the commission does not allow the reappointment of a commissioner once he or she has tabled their resignation. He says the three will be replaced as soon as Parliament has finalized the proposed bill for recruiting new commissioners.
You have cleared with the commission and you walk back saying, I want to sit here and work. There's everything wrong without maybe being reappointed to the position, which again is not possible with the IEBC because you serve once and go. Committee of Parliament, which oversights the commission, is working on a bill, and also the Senate committee is also working on a similar concept, so that we now have a situation where they set up a selection panel and then new commissioners will be recruited. So that's on course.
The three, led by Commissioner Margaret Mwachanya, called a news conference in April this year to announce their resignation. They accused Commission Chairperson Wafula Chebukati of poor leadership.
The Commission Chair has failed to be the steady and stable hand that steers the ship in difficult times and gives direction when needed. Instead, under his leadership, the Commission boardroom has become a venue for peddling money, misinformation, grounds for brewing mistrust, and a space for scrambling for and chasing individual glory and credit. We regret to announce our resignation from the commission with immediately effect.
Some political leaders like Senator Mutula Kilonzo Jr. have expressed their discomfort with the commissioner's suggestion that the three have gone against the constitution. Senator Kilonzo says the three should be prosecuted for absconding duty and resigning unlawfully.
Inaonekana wazi kwamba waliona tufumba macho sisi kama wa Kenya.
It is clear that the commissioners were lying to us Kenyans, and the government should not allow people who work like that. It means that they did not resign officially, and now they want to go back to work and do unlawful things they were doing at the commission before. The commissioners should be charged in parliament in the quickest way possible, because what they have done is against Chapter 6 of the Constitution of Kenya, which gives the public servant rules on how to pursue their work.
The commission has since last year faced rejection from opposition leaders and Kenyans at large, who blamed it for not being credible during the general election, a move that made the chairperson to suspend the commission's chief executive officer, Ezra Chiloba, for 4 months. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 28th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. South Sudan has resumed production of oil in the former Unity State, which was suspended when fighting spread to that area shortly after the conflict began in late 2013. South Sudan's petroleum minister says the government will produce 45,000 barrels of oil a day in the Toma oil fields. Mayang David Mayar reports from Juba.
South Sudan Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Olgatkwa says the government turned on the oil taps on Saturday and dark crude oil began being pumped into pipelines again, nearly 5 years after production was shut down due to clashes between government and rebel forces in the area. Speaking at the Toma South oil field on Saturday, where he personally turned on production facilities, Gatkwat said the resumption in oil production marks a new beginning for South Sudan.
We have now resumed the production officially in Toma South. We will be producing 45,000 barrels a day, gross, and we will be sending it to Ejlich. And my team, the Ministry of Petroleum of the Republic of South Sudan, GPOC, they will be here in Toma South, working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, to make sure that the production is not interrupted.
The government suspended oil production at Toma South and several other oil fields in the area in early 2014 when it was too dangerous to continue operations while government and opposition forces battled for the control of the oil fields. Some of the oil facilities were also said to be damaged during the fighting. Gatkwat says the government engineers are working with oil companies to ensure that oil fields in the former Unity State area are safely reopened.
The work is just starting. We have put into production Toma South. We are going to El Nar, Tor, Manga, Unity. Together, all of us, nobody's going to be left behind. GPOC, you take a lead, the rest will follow.
At the time South Sudan seceded from Sudan in 2011, oil production was at a peak of 350,000 barrels per day. South Sudan currently produces 130,000 barrels per day from oil fields in former Upper Nile State. That drop in oil production, together with the continuing conflict, has crippled the country's economy. Hel Ahzari Abdel Gadir, the Sudanese oil and gas minister, who witnessed the taps being turned back on over the weekend, says it is not too late for South Sudan to regain what it lost during the oil shutdown. But he says that will only happen if peace returns to South Sudan.
This is based, actually, on the initiative that has been taken by our president, al-Bashir, to his brother, president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, to bring peace into the country. And this is a product of that. And I can tell everyone, such products can be more and more if this peace perseveres and if we are determined to really continue to make sure that we nourish it and make sure that it continues.
The resumption of oil production follows a ceasefire and power-sharing agreement that President Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar and other rebel groups signed in Khartoum. South Sudan pays Sudan $25 per barrel for exporting its crude oil through Sudan and for using the Sudanese facilities, including refineries and pipelines, according to the 2012 cooperation agreement. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
Malawi President Peter Mutharika says allegations of corruption made against him by his own vice president are politically motivated and a complete nonsense. In an interview with the Financial Times newspaper, President Mutharika accused Vice President Saulos Chilima of wanting to be president. Mr. Chilima accused the president of rampant corruption and has since left the ruling Democratic People's Party to form his own political party, the United Transformation Movement, UTM. Patricia Kalia, Secretary General of the UTM, says the party is running an issues-based campaign ahead of the 2019 presidential vote.
That's his opinion. We are also seeing what is happening here. We only highlight the issue-based campaign which we are doing. We don't just take it as it is the case in which the president is committing. So if you think it's political, but it's a real situation on the ground, and that's what the UTM president, who is the vice president of this country, was talking about.
He says that Mr. Chilima is doing this because he wants to be president, and he says that corruption is not greater than it was before the Cashgate revelations.
That's what I was saying, that's his opinion. But as we are talking, as UTM, that's what we are telling people who have the situation of corruption in the country. So he's entitled to his opinion, if I may so say, I may say so.
Okay, what do you say to what the president said, that his government is doing more development in Malawi, and so if there was corruption, this development would not take place?
My brother, it's really very unfortunate that you are there. If you were here, you would have been with us, or you would have been to our side. Because some of the projects, the developments which you're talking about, were those which were already launched and the funding was there, but now it's nothing happening on the ground. But also, that's what I'm saying, we are failing to develop Malawi equally from north, central, south, and the east because of that corruption, whereby people, they go pretending to do whatever they're talking about in the actual sense, they're not doing it. But also, because of tribalism, regionalism, where people, they keep talking that this one speaks to this, or she's from this, or he's from this. That contributes as well to corruption as well as undeveloped areas which we are referring to. So if you're talking about development, we are talking about the corruption, which is the contributing factor of undeveloped areas.
There is a protest planned for September 7th. By civil society groups, which is intended to call on the president to resign. Is your party behind this protest that is coming up?
Now, what we are talking about is the issue of corruption. And if people are not happy with whatever is happening in the country, they're entitled to do that. That's what democracy is all about. We would like to see that our democracy is maturing each and every day. And we will not even allow democracy to be defeated because of corruption. And that's why those people, they have the right to be on the road marching for that.
Patricia Kaliyati is the Secretary General of the newly formed United Transformation Movement Party of Malawi. She was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Experts are warning that the world will see a resurgence of AIDS unless governments and communities stay committed to ending the epidemic. As viewer Carol Pearson reports, the virus is still spreading and continues to threaten all of us.
The face of AIDS has changed over the past three decades. It's now impossible to tell who has the disease and who doesn't. Treatment has come a long way, allowing people infected with what was once a death sentence to live normal, productive lives. Even those at risk of getting the virus can now take medication called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, to stay HIV-free. Dr. Chris Byrer says it's just the latest weapon in the growing medical arsenal against AIDS.
It's the most powerful new tool in prevention we've had in a generation of research. And what we're seeing is that if you combine treatment, so people living with the virus getting treated, and then people at risk having access to PrEP, you really can get control of HIV epidemic.
Yet AIDS claimed the lives of nearly 1 million people last year, and experts predict 100 million people will have been infected with the HIV virus by 2030. The reasons: complacency, reduced funding for AIDS research and treatment, and the difficulty of reaching people at risk. Another major problem, says Dr. Deborah Birx, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, is flagging government interest.
When we talk to ministers of finance, they always say to me, I thought HIV was over because I don't see anybody dying.
New AIDS infections are down from nearly 3.5 million a year, but remain stuck at just below 2 million. J. Stephen Morrison at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says there are currently 17 million people living with HIV who cannot be reached. Men who have sex with men, IV drug users, sex workers and their clients, and transgender people.
Those key populations and young women account for over 50% of new infections, and they are really hard to reach.
Morrison, Birx, and Byrer discuss the challenges in ending AIDS at a program in Washington to evaluate the messages from the International AIDS Conference in July. Byrer said the warning came through loud and clear.
And it is much too early to declare victory, and the risks of a resurgent epidemic are real.
The National Institutes of Health announced an international program to find ways to reduce the social stigma associated with AIDS. Domestically, the health agency found the highest number of untreated AIDS infections among the poor and in the Black and Hispanic communities. The agency says closing these treatment gaps is critical to ending AIDS in the U.S. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Up to 95% of all lemur species are either critically endangered or vulnerable, making them one of the most threatened groups of invertebrate animals in the world, according to experts attending a recent workshop in Madagascar. Chief Zoological Officer at the Bristol Zoological Society in the United Kingdom, Christopher Schweitzer, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the local efforts to save these endangered primates.
The main reason for lemur declines, lemur population declines in Madagascar is habitat loss, forest loss. Madagascar has already lost more than 80% of its original forest cover. Currently, there are about 16% of Madagascar land area still covered in what we would call a forest. And that's not much. I've been working in Madagascar since 2003. The human population has increased from 18 million to 27 million. So that's huge. And all these people, of course, need to eat something. So people go burn down a little bit of forest, plant their rice on the soil that is only made fertile by the layer of ash on it. After 2 or 3 years, the soil isn't fertile any longer. People then move on and do the same thing a couple of hundred meters down the road. And at times when there weren't many people and there was lots of forest, then this was a very sustainable method of agriculture. But now with loads of people in Madagascar and only very little forest left, it's highly unsustainable. So that's the main cause of population declines for lemurs. There are other causes as well. There is an increasing threat of hunting, of bushmeat hunting in Madagascar.
What do you and your colleagues suggest should happen? What are steps forward to improve this problem, to help save the lemurs?
So we've written a lemur conservation action plan a couple of years ago, published it in 2013, and are currently implementing this action plan. And that works quite well. There are 30 lemur conservation priority sites that we have identified in Madagascar, each of them containing communities of endangered or critically endangered lemur species. And for each of these sites, we want to implement a conservation project or several conservation projects, actually, under this, it's called SOS Lemurs Initiative. And there's an increasing community of young and very dedicated Malagasy primatologists and conservationists who are doing the work. So we are not short of people.
Oftentimes, there's interesting or unique community efforts to solve these issues. What kind of efforts are the local primatologists creating?
So there is this this growing league of young Malagasy conservationists who are really very keen and very skilled. These are our best hope. There are certainly a number of very, very enthusiastic and keen local Malagasy NGOs that are up and coming at the moment that are working in different sites across the country to tackle threats to lemurs. And talking about local people, so at grassroots level.
That was Christopher Schweitzer, Chief Officer at the Bristol Zoological Society in the United Kingdom. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. And that's it for this Tuesday, August 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer, John Ellison, I'm James Butte saying have a good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, pressure mounts on Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni over the beating and detention of music star Bobby Wine. And we'll discuss the legacy of Kofi Annan on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Come celebrate the 60th birthday of legendary King of Pop, Michael Jackson, on Wednesday, August 29th, with a very special edition of Border Crossings. Join Larry London as he takes you back through time with a full hour of Michael Jackson's greatest hits. With a career spanning over 40 years, Michael Jackson gave us plenty of songs to choose from. Don't miss Border Crossings on Wednesday, August 29th at 1500 Universal, as we pay tribute to one of the greatest pop stars of all time.